This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 88 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut, and David Vanderhoof is off this episode. Now, he sends his deep apologies, and we expect him to return next week. But before you get concerned that you're only going to get half a show without David, well, I'm joined by one of our past guests, and that's Mark Burns from Burns Eye View. Hi, Mark. Thanks for stepping in.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great to have you back. Now, as our listeners know, you own Burns Eye View. That's the promotion and marketing company. It specializes in aerial filming. And we talked to Mark back in episode 83 after Burns Eye View became the 16th company in the United States to receive a Section 333 exemption from the FAA. Then last week, we discussed the FAA policy change designed to streamline the process of getting a Certificate of Waiver or Authorization, a COA, for holders of Section 333 exemptions. So Mark is here to share his opinions and offer his experience with this policy change. Hopefully, we'll have some time for a few news items. We've got a few solar electric drones in the news. Also, Amazon has been testing in Canada, and an interesting little item on morphing robotic wings. So, Mark, if you're all set, let's get started.
Let's do this.
Now, Mark, I understand since your guest appearance on the show that you've actually heard from quite a number of our listeners from really a variety of different locations.
Yeah, I didn't realize, Max, how popular this show was across the country. Wow. It was pretty fantastic. I've heard from your listeners in Canada, here in California, Texas, North Carolina, and actually quite a few other exempted companies. So it's been a real treat to get phone calls and emails from all over North America.
It's almost like a club in some ways, right? A bunch of people that sort of share common objectives and issues and problems. It's nice that the community is kind of, involved and eager to make some progress collectively. So, and you're a big part of that, I think. Maybe you didn't start out to be that sort of leading edge kind of a guy, but that's kind of where you've turned out to be.
Well, it's turning into a great community to be a part of. So I'm very excited to dig my heels in and learn more about everything here and meet the great people that I've already come in contact with and get to know the people who really know what's going on.
Now, as you know, we received an email from Doug Branch from Like on a Tree Aerial. And that's another one of the companies that had received an exemption under Section 333. Doug wrote to us and says that in reading through his blanket COA, he says it will actually simplify much of the work and lead time that would have been required to begin filming or surveying. He says the conditions and limitations within my original exemption still apply, and there are some other standard provisions that additionally apply when using the blanket COA. For example, the NOTAM process will still be required, but in my first read-through, he says, it appears that it will be more realistic in terms of time frame for notification. He says not quite an hour before flight, but better than weeks or days before an operation. So, Mark, does that kind of echo what you've seen as a result of this?
Yeah, I think it's a really good synopsis of what we're looking at here in the language. I was a little disappointed that the NOTAM still need to be required because you're still looking at, you know, a 3-day process to get that approved. But it's definitely a movement in the right direction. One of the things that I was thought was most interesting is they have here that you're supposed to report every 30 days your flights. And I'll put this on our blog post for everybody to go to our website and they can look at it themselves. But it says the documentation of all operations associated with UAS activities is required regardless of the airspace in which the UAS operates. And then note, negative or zero flight reports are required.
So even if you don't fly, they want to hear about that as well.
Even if we don't fly. So it's pretty ridiculous. And they don't say anything else more about this zero flight reporting in the document. But I'm curious to see who's going to say, oh, I didn't fly. Oh, I didn't fly. Also, further down in the document, it gives a little better breakdown of where you can and can't fly in regards to location to airfields. And it's 5 nautical miles from any airport having an operational tower.
Okay.
3 nautical miles from any airport having a published instrument flight procedure but not having a tower. 2 nautical miles from any airport not having a published instrument flight procedure or operational control tower, and 2 nautical miles from any heliport. So it's breaking it down a little bit more. The most important thing, I think, for everybody to recognize here is that at the very end of the document, it goes into that this certificate of waiver or authorization does not waive any Title 14 code of federal regulations or any state law or local ordinance. Should the proposed operation conflict with any state law or local ordinance or require permission of local authorities or property owners, it is the responsibility of the operator to resolve the matter. This COA does not authorize flight within special use airspace without approval from the scheduling agency, and the operator is hereby authorized to operate the small unmanned aircraft system in the national airspace.
One way to interpret that maybe is that the FAA is saying that their requirements don't supersede local requirements. Is that kind of in effect what's happening here?
I think so. It's kind of a flip of primacy law of a local, state, and federal, as far as I understand it. So I think what the listeners need to understand is that you need to make sure that you're active in your communities, educating, you know, law enforcement and politicians on what's going on, how you're operating, and make sure that you're, you know, making friends with law enforcement so they know who you are, and if there's any issues, you have a head start in, you know, explaining your case. I think also the other interesting thing is that in the last sentence, the operator is hereby authorized to operate this small unmanned aircraft system in the national airspace. So the FAA is totally saying that 200 feet and below is national airspace. And I think that's we're moving in the wrong direction there.
Yeah, that's been the basis for a lot of discussion and conversation, that this seems to be a kind of a different approach. You know, we have national airspace and navigable airspace, and whereas in the past the FAA kind of drew a line and kind of claimed responsibility above that, they're really kind of dropping it down to the grass now and saying,
exactly.
You know, they've got the whole thing under their purview.
It is interesting if you let your grass grow, you know, maybe 2 or 3 feet, yeah, that you can raise the level of national airspace.
Right, right.
Should you mow it.
but I think your advice is good in terms of working with local authorities, whether that's police or, you know, or whatever is applicable in your area. And you really can't blame the authorities, if you will, for not having a good understanding of what these things are all about. Because, I mean, where do they get their information from? Well, either nowhere if they're not really paying attention to it, or if they are, just, you know, from the press stories in their own kind of preconceived notions. So there really is, sort of in the absence of regulatory direction, a lot of awareness that has to be built with local authorities And if you're flying, yeah, I think I agree with you, Mark. It really behooves yourself to, you know, work with these people. And maybe it's a lot of effort on your part to kind of bring them along and down the learning curve, but it's only going to help, I think.
People need to be friendly. And we had an incident today where, not necessarily an incident, but we were observing someone flying a DJI Inspire. Hmm. And there were some people who are spectating and watching it, and they're complaining that it was invading their privacy. Now, we are in a public park, and the pilot was flying safely. Mm-hmm. And we took it upon ourselves to educate this lady that, you know, first of all, you don't have an expectation of privacy because you're in a public area. And it's no different than having a camera 40 feet up. You're taking pictures. It just is, we need to get people off their first initial response to, oh, this is strange or weird, or I don't like it, to calmly explaining what's going on. We want to fly safely because we want to get our craft back.
Now, you've had some conversations with the FISDOs, right? The FAA Flight Standards District offices, and you kind of learned some interesting things, I think.
Yeah, some of this might not be new to your listeners, but it certainly was new to me. I believe you've talked about Steve Garrard up in Portland, Maine, who got a phone call from the FAA saying that, you know, need to take down his website and stop flying. And that certainly struck me as, you know, definitely over the line. And so when I saw a company on primetime TV flying an obvious GoPro shot, I kind of got fed up and wanted to stick up for Steve and everybody else out there. And I called the local FSDO and said, hey, what's going on? Why are these companies allowed to do this? And they said, well, send us an email and we'll investigate. So I sent them an email, and this is what I said. I said, you know, small UAS businesses and individual operators are often the target of FAA enforcement. While broadcast TV companies routinely flaunt the FAA and operate UASs with impunity, selling airtime to advertisers without penalty. And so my point was, hey, you're picking on people like Steve Garrard up in Maine. I've gone through the exemption process. Are you going to enforce anything on obvious commercial operations, trying to make them take a stand with the broadcasters? So I sent this email in, and the blogs, I put the email on our blog so people can check that out on our site too. So what they came back to me in the phone call that I received a few days later was that they're only here, at least in LA, they're only going to investigate a violation if there's a complaint, if there's an eyewitness, and if it can be provable that a small UAV or UAS was used. And this kind of struck me because they asked me to send in a complaint if I wanted to. They said they'd investigate, and essentially they made a phone call and said, we're not going to investigate because there's no possible way we could prove it. So the FSD up in Portland seems to be an outlier in this. But what it taught me is that these FSDOs are really based off of the personality of the people working there. Hmm. Now, every time I've talked to these people, they've been great people, but there's not a uniform application of the rules across the board. So LA seems to be more lax. San Diego seems to be a little more by the letter than LA does. And, you know, Portland seems to be quite militant in their interpretation of things. Hmm. Furthermore, they said that we are hoping for voluntary compliance and that they're only going to send a letter if they do investigate and determine that the party was outside the rules, and that the letter is a reminder to please voluntarily comply, and that they recognize that there are no federal aviation regulations on UAVs at this point. So what your listeners need to understand is, yeah, exempted companies are exempted, whatever that is meaning in the actual application of flying. But until these new rules are adopted by the FAA, which we could be looking at, you know, 2017 or late 2016, there, as long as you're flying safely, the FAA is not going to do anything against you. So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of bravado out there, but when it comes down to what's really going to happen, fly safely, you're going to be able to get the shots you want to get. The funny thing for me was, so this is the FAA, Department of Transportation, LA FSDO office said that they have limited resources to investigate and enforce SUAS flights. Now, I'm talking as a small business owner, and I definitely know that I don't have the ability to lobby Congress for more money.
Right.
I'm like, I felt like I'm in surreal land where I have limited resources. You guys don't have limited resources. So bottom line is, until the NPRM is adopted, the FAA has nothing to enforce. Compliance is voluntary only. You know, fly safely. Know what your, you know, where manned aircraft are. Stay out of their way. Don't hit any obstacles, obviously. But the key point is, get in touch with your police departments, your local cities and towns. Understand where they are and try and be an advocate for safe flying of UAS.
And I think that most of the commercial operators that I've run across or read about or had some insight into are pretty good when it comes to flying safely. I think that the amateurs, the hobbyists, that's kind of maybe where most of the danger is. But the guys who are up there with, big, expensive multi-copters with thousands of dollars of camera equipment hanging from it with off of, very expensive gimbals and the whole thing. I mean, there's a big investment there. So there's a motivation to fly safely if for no other reason than to protect the equipment. But of course, I think there's also recognition that, besides that, there's protecting the property and people on the ground who are not involved in your flights, and that if we start to see some significant accidents resulting from unsafe flying, that it just puts the whole industry in a state of danger in terms of being able to move forward doing anything before the rules are adopted by the FAA.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the local PD, your town, are going to be the first responders if there is an incident. And that's why, your operator out there needs to, make sure that they're a good ambassador for the industry. I was on the beach the other day, and there's a lady who was given a Phantom by her husband, and she was out there with her brother, and they were probably late to mid-30s, and it was her third total flight of ever flying RC. And she was being very responsible, just doing little maneuvers, and was getting more comfortable. And I walked up and I was like, hey, looks great. Just trying to make friends. And they're like, what kind of pointers do you have? And so said a few things, but it was great seeing a lady out there doing it. It was great seeing new operators who were cautious and were just looking to have a good time.
Sure.
And so very encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope we see a lot more of that and a lot less flying over crowded areas or sporting events, things like that, by people who really have no business doing that.
Agreed.
All right. So any final comments on the recent FAA policy change in terms of what you've learned or how it's going to impact you?
It's really not going to impact me that much. I have not been flying. I'm waiting, honestly, to get my amendment for an S-1000 to come through.
All right. Yes, I remember we talked about that before because...
I think we're over the 60-day mark at this point, so hopefully we're getting close to getting that approved. And the reason I'm waiting is because to get the N number, in talking with Oklahoma office of the FAA, they're the ones that issue the N numbers for the aircraft. They said if an agency or individual doesn't have an N number, they'll get expedited priority and get the N number within 2 weeks. If you already have an N number on another aircraft, then it'll take up to 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's kind of funny logic, huh?
Yeah. I'm not really pushing to get an N number on my Phantom, but when the S-1000 comes through, then I will make sure that I get everything. Actually, I reserved my number. I have 5 numbers reserved. Excited about that.
Right. Yep.
But just kind of waiting for the S-1000 come through and then putting forward the Phantom and the S-1000, our Phantoms and S-1000 for that. So, yeah, that's kind of where I am. But as far as the blanket COA, it's great as far as moving in the right direction. I'd love for the NOTAM requirement to be removed.
That's kind of the big remaining item in terms of making commercial flying practical, I guess.
And I don't quite understand why they think that an airplane that's at 200 feet and below is going to be that worried about drones or UAVs when obviously something else is the issue.
All right. Well, good, Mark. Appreciate that. Why don't we touch on a few of the news stories that we've been looking at this week. Many of them come in from our listeners. We got this one from Mark, a different Mark, from Flying Mag or Flying Magazine. First solar electric drone enters production. This is the Silent Falcon, and this comes from the Silent Falcon UAS Technologies company. It's a solar electric aircraft. It's a composite fixed wing, and it has solar cells on the wings. This is kind of viewed as being a long duration, long range kind of small UAS. Mark, I guess solar cells on drones is something that sort of was bound to happen.
Yeah, what a fantastic article. I mean, this is great. This is where the industry should be going. Battery life is always an issue.
Sure. And
what a fantastic way to increase your flight times. And it looks from the picture that it is quite large and it has quite the camera array on it. So exciting, exciting stuff. This is a great find by Mark.
I think that there's all kinds of development going on, research going on to develop technologies that can support operation of UAS, like in this particular case. We're actually looking to bring more examples into the show of the research that's being done in the UAS arena, sort of not necessarily directly involving UAS capabilities, but things that can complement unmanned aircraft or situations where unmanned aircraft can be utilized where they maybe couldn't now. Because there's lots of exciting stuff going on. This kind of solar energy example is just one of them. But speaking of solar energy, we also found an article in Aviation Week concerning Facebook and their UAV. We've talked about this in the past, this concept of a atmospheric satellite. This is something that would fly very high altitude, like in the stratosphere. Facebook's idea is that this would provide internet connectivity where that's not available in remote parts of the world. So they have apparently, reportedly, had a first flight. Now, it's a subscale prototype. They call it the Aquila, this prototype of a solar-powered unmanned aircraft. They're working on the full-scale version. That's still under construction. But, yeah, this is an interesting kind of application. A company like Facebook doing this is... Some people will say, well, that's crazy. What does Facebook know about building UAVs? But they have a lot of really talented people working on this. But also, Google's got a similar concept, Mark. I think that's...
They're calling it Project Titan.
Right. And they're also looking for flight trials to occur sometime this year, 2015.
What a fabulous industry to be a part of. I mean, this is just exciting stuff. I mean, Facebook's UAV wants to fly 60 to 90,000 feet.
Right.
I mean, yes. that's just fantastic. This is just really neat. It reminds me of a guy that I spoke with, Chris. He is with Viking UAS. Hmm. He just got exempted in the past, I think, 30 to 45 days. And he was telling me about his son, who has gotten clearance to fly fixed wing UAV up to 100,000 feet to set a Guinness World Record.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
His son's 16. He's doing with a group of kids from school. And Chris is a really neat guy. He's got some really neat stuff. And he's actually one of the manufacturers here in the United States of a fixed wing and multi-rotor model aircraft and UAVs. So if there's your listeners out there who are looking for some company to talk to about making their own craft, I'd talk to Viking UAS.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, this feels to me a lot like when the space program in the United States was kind of getting started. Now, I know many of you listening to this, maybe you weren't born at that point, but for us old guys, it was a very exciting time. It really energized a lot of people. to get involved, to begin careers in space. And in some ways, this feels very similar to me, that unmanned aircraft is sort of opening up all these opportunities, all these possibilities. Certainly a lot of people are interested, young people especially, in getting involved in these kinds of things. And, you know, I almost said in the sky's the limit, but but it's kind of true. You know, there's really kind of unlimited potential just waiting to be tapped.
Nathan, my 15-year-old son, he's excited about writing code for him.
Sure, yes, yeah.
I mean, for the industry. It's so cool. So if any of your listeners out there are looking for an intern for the summer, send me an email and I'll get you in touch with my son, Nathan. He'd love to work with you.
Oh, cool. Very good. We have another item. This came in from David, not our David, a different David. Amazon tests delivery drones at secret Canada site after U.S. frustration. This was kind of interesting. This comes from The Guardian, and they report that Amazon is testing package delivery technology at a, quote, secret site in British Columbia, Canada. But they say they've actually got plain clothed security guards around this thing to keep people away. Amazon has bought some land, and they're conducting tests up in Canada because of frustration with being able to or not being able to conduct tests outdoors in the U.S.
I mean, this is where what industry does. They move to where they can operate. Good on Amazon for dressing down the FAA with when they finally got their approval, but they had said the model aircraft that they had gotten approval or exempted to fly, they no longer use. But this is, I mean, this is great for Amazon and moving their interests forward and working in Canada.
Yeah.
I see here that they're looking to use airspace from 200 to 500 feet to carry a 5-pound or less package, and that represents 86%. Of all the packages they ship. Mm. They're looking to decrease their costs. And
yeah,
good for them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, I applaud that. I just wonder about the 200 feet and below part of the delivery process. You know, how they're gonna do that without the, you know, the neighborhood dog chasing after the copter or the package. There just seems like there's a lot of issues to be worked out. But, you know, hey, you can, with enough time and effort and energy and enthusiasm, you can figure anything out, I think.
Yeah, hey, if Santa can get down the chimney, I bet Amazon can get get my book to, yeah. to my front door.
last item. This is from Unmanned Systems Technology. This is titled Morphing Robotic Wing Developed to Help Drones Manage Collisions. This comes out of Stanford University, some research. And what they've done is they looked at things like birds and bats and creatures like that and how they navigate through obstacles, things like tree branches or, you know, that sort of thing. And what they do is they move around and sort of change the shape of their wings. So what these guys have tried to do is say, how do we do this in a device made by man? So they've got something that they some wings that they use carbon fiber and mylar film. This thing has a wrist joint involved in it, and the idea is that this thing could on its own change the shape of the wings to make it or to cause it to sort of navigate through obstacles a little more successfully, or I guess if it hits something, it reacts in a more positive way. So yeah, here we go again with another example of something that, you know, is we probably wouldn't be studying this, at least to this degree, if it weren't for you know, the motivation of figuring out how to make drones survive like this.
I guess this is why I didn't go to Stanford. I would just avoid the tree altogether, but they want to go through it. So yeah. Good on them.
Yeah. So we'll have links to all those stories in the show notes, of course, as always. So you can find those there. One listener mail before we close out. We heard from Stuart, who sent us an article about drone development in Alaska. And this talks about the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration, which is one of the six FAA UAS test sites. And this is funded, I guess, through the University of Alaska, and there was going to be, or there appeared to be a problem with the budget and not getting the money for this, which would be somewhat problematic. But apparently the State Senate subcommittee has taken some action to restore the money needed for the next fiscal year, nearly $1.9 million. So that's good news. So thanks to Stuart for sending that in.
Yeah, it's very interesting that the locations of these FAA UAS test sites are kind of all over the country. And for Alaska, I mean, they're looking at how cold weather is going to affect UAS flights. So battery life, you know, you want to make everything out of metal. So the plastic would fatigue sooner than the metal would. So there's a lot of different elements to consider. And I'm glad that this has been funded. So that's great.
Yeah, there really are a lot of elements to consider. I mean, it's easy for us to think that, you know, we've kind of got this figured out, but there really are a lot of things to figure out. Like you mentioned, cold weather and just all kinds of stuff that's still out there waiting to be dealt with. All right, just to give you an update on the NPRM count, since we've been doing this for a couple of episodes. So as of this recording, the number of comments received on the FAA's NPRM for commercial use of small UAS is up to 2,530. That's a lot of comments.
That's great.
It is good. Now, some of these comments are, well, not very productive. Let's put it that way. and can probably easily be pruned out of the total. But still, that's a lot of stuff for the FAA to go through. Too much feedback makes the process take longer, but I think I'd rather have too much than not enough. Also, as we mentioned, if you want to take a look at the regulations.gov webpage where you can find the NPRM or submit your comments online, we have a shortcut link for that. Just go to the uavdigest.com/NPRM and that'll redirect you to that site. And of course, comments are due on or before April 24th of this year, 2015.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I have two things I'd like to add, if I can.
Sure, go ahead, Mark.
For everybody who's listening, I will be at NAB in Las Vegas in April, the middle of the month. So if anybody wants to send me an email, I'd love to meet up with you and we can talk shop. But also, I've been confirmed as a panelist at the Unmanned Systems Institute conference in September 23rd through the 25th. I'll be on a breakout panel on the 25th. So I encourage everybody who's in the Las Vegas area to look into going there. There'll be a lot of neat people to meet, neat operations to start to understand. And that's going to be in September. So excited about speaking there.
Congratulations on doing that. That's fantastic. All right. Well, you've been listening to episode 88 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at the uavdigest.com. And if you'd like to go straight to the show notes, that's the uavdigest.com/88 for episode 88. Mark Burns, we want to thank you for joining us on this episode. Where can we follow you online?
My company's name is Burns Eye View. So we're burnseyeview.com, and that's Burns with a Z. So feel free to look us up on our website. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, all the social networks. We look at Twitter the most, so feel free to tweet us, email us, or comment on our website.
All right, very good. And thanks again for joining us. And
yeah, my pleasure. Appreciate it, Max.
All right. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. We're also on Facebook, UAV Digest. If you'd like to send us email, that's feedback@theuavdigest.com. If you want to send it right to me, you can use max@theuavdigest.com or to David at david@theuavdigest.com. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, wherever you find your podcasts. We encourage you to subscribe. And if you're not sure how to do that, well, just write to us and we'll help get you started. We're also on Stitcher.com. You can stream us there right to your mobile device. We also have some swag if you'd like to get some UAV Digest t-shirts and things like that, cafepress.com/theUAVDigest. We also have a way that you can contribute, support us financially through Patreon. That's at patreon.com/theUAVDigest. Or to make it easier, you can just visit theuavdigest.com/patron. And we also have buttons on our webpage that will link you straight to that. Well, with that, I'll say that this is Max in Hartford.
And this is Mark in California.
Thanks for listening.